Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Initiative Podcast. I'm Dr. Eric Crampton, Chief Economist with the Initiative. With me today, we've got Danil McLaughlin. Danil is one of the country's top political writers. He's often featured in The Listener. He's on Substack often as well. And, well, he's one of the more insightful columnists from the center-left-ish, maybe, on New Zealand politics and what's going on here. He's written recently on turmoil in Wellington's pipe network. He writes more broadly on the state of politics and the state of the polity. And we're going to have a chat today through some of this. So welcome, Danil.
Howdy, Eric.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
So you'd started looking through what the heck had happened with Wellington's pipes. How have we gotten into this mess?
It's still not clear to me. Like, the purpose of that column with like a lot of things I write is that I just don't really understand what's happened. So I try to talk to everybody that I can. And in this one, I came out still not really understanding what went wrong there. Talking to staffers at that council, is that an observation that a lot of the councils were never really that interested in the pipes just because they're under the ground, so they're not that obvious, and they always worked. Nothing really went wrong with them, so there was a sort of, why should we be spending all this money on something that just already works? And so, obviously, you know, that has not served the city very well. But there must also have been, you would think that you would have like, I don't know if we have a city engineer, we used to have a city manager, we used to have these titles.
Town clerk.
Yeah, yeah. And they would, I don't know, in my imagination have been saying, no, we really do need to maintain our basic water infrastructure. That's going to go very badly if we don't do that. But I don't think we have those anymore. You know, the most influential people are the CE, there's a chief operating officer, and they're more managerial. They're not kind of from an engineering or civic engineering background. So yeah, that seems to have kind of vanished from local government, those sort of high level technical positions.
Well, it seems almost structural, right? Because Wellington Water is set as a kind of a council owned organization, yeah, jointly across several of the region's councils, except it is only a water management company. It doesn't own the pipes. It doesn't set the rates on the pipes. It doesn't get to direct its own budget. It gets to invest based on what money the separate councils throw at it from time to time. It had felt like for a period, they had become despondent about even bothering to ask for money because they were expecting to get turned down. Yeah. So more recently, councillors have been able to say, we've given them everything they asked for, except in the very most recent period where things have gone a little bit weird. It seems to be a structure that's designed for failure. If you've got a management company that can't make its own decisions over the pipes, and the ones that decide on the budget don't really have any responsibility for how the state of the pipes, like, how can you expect good outcomes from that kind of an institutional structure?
There's a very deep enmity at the moment between the council and its own water management. And so there's kind of almost like an ongoing war of sort of leaks and background briefings between the two, and so that generates a lot of the media. It does seem like quite a dysfunctional organization, and I talk about that, I think, a little bit in the column about how, like a lot of Wellington-based organizations, it's obsessed with media, spends just enormous amounts of money trying to kind of manage the media coverage with, I think it was $350,000 to Sweeney Vesti, and it's hard to see what that bought. Like, they don't have very good, you know, their brand is terrible because they've been involved in the destruction of the water infrastructure. So that's hard to spin. It's hard to put a positive message on that. And, you know, the councillors don't really, the complaint they have is that they don't know where the money is going when they give money to this organization, that it seems to be costing more and paying for less on an almost continuous basis. So that's why they're reluctant to give their company more funding, although they've kind of turned around. It's just because they don't think it's a good use of the ratepayers' money. But they also own the company, so you would think that they would have a little more agency over how it works and what it does, but it feels like they don't.
Ideally, you'd want that kind of an organization really to be arm's length so that councillors would not be able to raid it for other things, except now they're in a spot where we've all got like little bits of information from around the sides of it, like a friend that I trust talked to somebody who would know that it appears it takes about three times as much paperwork and process to get a leak patched here as it did in another council, but you can't get anything systematic on it that you'd be able to actually cite in a report. The whole structure needs to be changed to get better outcomes.
Yeah. And something interesting about them raiding the maintenance fund is that it becomes apparent talking to them that the councillors don't have that much power. I went to interview a minister the other day in the Beehive, and they have like a ministerial office suite. and there's all these staff, and ministers have agency and they can make stuff happen. And the councillors, I don't think they have an office. Like, they've just moved quite recently, so maybe they have offices now. I doubt they do. But yeah, they have no offices, they have no staff. None of the council employees really are accountable to councillors in any way. The mayor has a little bit more soft power. Like, if the mayor says something, then that might have an influence. But yeah, so the one thing that they do have some agency over is the budget. They can draw up these long-term budgets and vote for where the money goes. And I kind of think that because they can't do anything else, there's a strong incentive for them to do stuff in there. If they're going to have any kind of impact, it's going to be redirecting money around and pulling money out of, you know, the pipes budget and spending it on something else. Although even then, it feels like a lot of those decisions are made in these workshops, which we've heard about, and which the council employees kind of brief the councillors and say, this is like the single option that you have for, you know, on the town hall, for example, and there are no alternatives. And this is what you're going to say to your constituents in the media after you have voluntarily made this decision that we've told you to make. So even on that, it feels like they're almost completely captured and powerless.
It must be an incredibly frustrating spot to be in, getting elected to try to make the city work better and not being able to actually do much. Not a great role.
I think this is why the current mayor, Tory Farnow, is still pushing ahead with this project to buy the Reading Cinema for $32 million. Which just seems like such a crazy thing to be doing. But if that's not happening, then she's probably looking at her term as a mayor and thinking, well, what was the point of any of this? And that's not because, you know, she's had experience in the Beehive. She was a senior political staffer and she sort of would make things happen if you could make things happen, I think. But it's I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, early Star Trek, you have the Kobayashi Maru, which is this, you know, it's a training simulation and it's an unwinnable mission and it's designed to sort of like teach people that some situations are unwinnable, so how do you cope? And the councillor in mayoralty in Wellington is just that. It's unwinnable. There's no move you can make that is going to solve these problems that are built into the way the council itself is organised.
It seems a little defeatist, right? Because there are moves that could be made on some of these. For example, on the town hall, it had looked pretty obvious that if council could organize itself to get a local bill up that would get rid of basically all of the heritage protections in the district plan. The typical New Zealand thing is you see the first hurdle that would stop you from doing something and then you realize, you say, okay, well, we can't do anything.
Yeah.
In that one, well, they would not have, the advice they'd gotten from officials is, well, you can't do anything about town hall. We have to have it strengthened by date X or we're out of compliance with central government legislation and unspecified bad things will happen to us if we're out of compliance. And it sure would be a bad look if we weren't complying. And the only way to get something done by that deadline was to spend $320 million or whatever, strengthening it. Of course, in the Kobayashi Maru, as you will remember, Kirk reprogrammed the computer to make it winnable.
Yep.
And reprogram the computer here would be a local bill that would go through saying, henceforth, by a simple majority vote, Wellington Council can remove any listed building from the district plan. Right? That'd be a pretty easy local bill to pass, and then council, by simple majority vote, could delist the town hall, and then it's no longer a heritage building, and they could make more sensible decisions about how to strengthen it or whether to strengthen it, right? Now, you'd want to be a little bit clever in the drafting of the bill to make sure that it was non-justiciable and that there wouldn't be a building so delisted would be deemed to have zero special value in any other consenting process of any kind forever, so that they wouldn't just impute heritage value to it after it had been delisted, because otherwise the wreckers go in and just try and litigate it through the courts. I don't know why they've not pursued this option. Local bills are pretty fast. They can go through there. It's like every fortnight, right?
Yeah, no, I don't know why they haven't done that, and I didn't ask about that.
Yeah.
So I kind of suspect that there would be just intense bureaucratic resistance. It's something the council as an organization wouldn't want to do, and it's hard for them to kind of act against the interest of their own officials.
Well, I think it's worse than that. Yeah. I think that deep down, some of them don't want agency, because if council had the right to delist buildings, well, some of the councillors wouldn't like that because they are happy to spend far more than anybody else would want on heritage buildings. So to threaten that choke point that they've got, and right now they can just throw their hands up and say, oh, it's not our fault, central government rules, we have to do this. If they actually had agency, then they'd have responsibility and accountability.
Yeah, and they do tend to push everything onto central government, but the central government, it's a left-wing council, and the central government was left-wing for 6 years. So you would think some arrangement could have been made there, but nothing happened. I mean, actually, well, I mean, the plan was that all the water gets hypothecated into a Three Waters mega entity, and so the liability gets taken off the council's books. So I guess in that respect, there was a plan there.
They were planning on getting a bailout, and then now they're going to have to eat the consequences of the past couple decades, right?
Yep. So yeah, there was a plan. It just fell down when the government changed.
I think that's for the best, because I don't think that there's any good reason for people in Wairarapa or elsewhere to be subsidizing Wellington, having decided over years and years to throw money into convention centers rather than keeping the pipes up.
Yeah. So we were just talking about The Power Broker, the Robert Moses book, and that's about local government and on like a massive scale, the city of New York. And one of the things that it describes in his various techniques, he was the city planner of New York for 40 years, to make politicians do whatever he wants, is sunk cost fallacy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is exactly what we've seen in Wellington with something like the town hall. He would, or just the infrastructure projects, he would always quote about a tenth of what he knew the eventual cost of something would be. And then once that money has gone in, it's very hard for a politician to say, no, actually, that's a write-off. We were misled and we didn't understand what was happening and we made quite a poor decision. And so you have to just keep pouring money in the case of the town hall, like in a very literal way, to avoid the appearance that you've kind of been conned by one of your own officials.
Yeah, and you kind of worry about that kind of process again with whatever's going on with the Reading Cinema, right? So even if they've got the numbers right on that one, there have to be 1,000 other businesses that now are thinking, okay, well, council is happy
to buy my land.
Well, effectively give them a massive interest rate subsidy on borrowing by having council guarantee it, right? Yeah. So the stream of projects that come through, at least some of them are going to end up following that dynamic where they'll undershoot on costs and then expect that council won't want to have their underwritten project fall over.
So the Amora Hotel, really close to Reading, it's hard to see why you would bail out Reading and not that hotel, which is an even larger and more strategically important space. So yeah, there's a slippery slope there that once you do it once, it's hard to say why you shouldn't do it for almost every structure in the city.
It's stupid for all of those reasons, but then you just start thinking about council's balance sheet, right? Yeah. So a lot of local councils are pushing up against their debt limits, that if they issue more debt relative to their revenues, they would be in breach of covenants on what they're allowed to do borrowing through the LGFA. And in the limit, there's potential for LGFA to recall all of the loans on a 30-day payback period, which would mean they'd have to go out to broader market to refinance the things at a much higher interest rate and get the sticker shock of that. So councils don't want to do that. Of course, revenue is the other way of changing the debt to revenue limit, but just sticking with debt. Why would you load your balance sheet up with debt for projects like Reading Cinema or other bailouts if they weren't generating a whole lot more revenue? It's constraining you against other things like borrowing to fix the pipes. And there's going to be a huge balance sheet constraint that's going to be coming in yet on Wellington Council, depending on how things go with the local water done well project that National's progressing. Because all of the water assets, the debt that's currently associated with the water assets, and all of the water system revenues will go into one balance sheet separate from Council's balance sheet. Water revenues that currently go into Council will no longer go into Council. They won't count against a Council debt limit. It just seems like so crazy to be loading up a balance sheet with other stuff that isn't really generating much in revenue.
And again, you've got that risk of the sunk cost, whereas if in 5 years' time they say, Reading says, actually, this is going to cost a lot more than we quoted you, the council is going to be in that same impossible position. Do we write off all this money?
Like even if they've got formal exit routes in whatever they're negotiating.
Which they won't.
They may well, I don't know. But even if they do, the political dynamics make it hard to exit at those points, because somebody will always say, oh, well, from where we are, it's only an extra $100 million, and think about the value of whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like they've done with Town Hall.
Yes. Which is still, I walked past it the other day, it's still just a massive construction site. I think 2026 is the, so that'll have been 13 years, I think.
We moved to Wellington in 2014, and I've never seen the thing in operation since moving here.
It's nice.
I'm sure it's very nice. People speak about the wonderful acoustics of it, but we're not a big town, and we've got a big budget hole. So
yeah. So housing, should we talk about the housing?
Well, I think we should. You'd mentioned earlier the independent hearings process. A survey came out from the New Zealand Economics Association. And I guess I'll give a little bit of background before that. We'll talk a little bit about the IHP and then get back to the consensus of economists. So backstory, Wellington Council had come to a district plan that was fairly enabling. It reduced the scope of character protection areas that restrict more townhouses and more building. It went to the independent hearings panel for review. The set of panelists came in, they reviewed it, they heard evidence, and they decided that, well, you remind us what they decided.
They decided, I mean, I struggle to remember all the dumb stuff, but basically that increasing supply of houses didn't have any effect on price or availability. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. It's a pretty fair summary. A bunch of the residents' associations that care deeply about character seem to have co-funded an expert witness who agreed with them that character protections really don't cost anything.
And I think it was Business Desk that revealed that the panel itself just had massive conflicts of interest that they hadn't disclosed. They owned millions of dollars in the areas that they were trying to restrict as character areas.
Do you know, or does anybody know, which side of which drawn lines those properties landed on?
Mount Victoria, I think.
Well, I mean, rather, like if it was me and if I wanted to make sure that I got a big capital gain through what I was doing in drawing lines for zones and character areas, I'd want to make sure that the character area did not include my property and that I was just on the other side of it, because then I could get all of the value uplift from being allowed to build things on my site, right?
And then you've got a moat around that, so no one else can,
You'd want it to be really, really restrictive on all properties that aren't my house.
Yeah.
That's the ideal, because then...
That's the dream.
That's the dream, right? Your property then goes up by like $10 million or something. You put up the apartment tower on just your site, and everywhere else is the Bailey around your mot.
I guess there's also, I mean, Mount Victoria seems to be that sort of heart of the NIMBY project in Wellington, and there's a large constituency of people there. It would be hard to convince them you need to agree that just my house is going to be turned into an apartment tower. Yeah, there's a large constituency of people that just want to keep the character of the area the same as it is, all these, you know, nice old restored Victorian villas, and to keep it kind of quiet. So, yeah, any allowance of a massive construction would be against their interest, so it would be hard to sell that to them, I think.
Yeah, so it went to the IHP. Their expert, Tim Helm, provided evidence suggesting that a city only has so much absorptive capacity. Yep. And if you zone for more building than the city's inherent absorptive capacity, then it will not increase the amount of building. Yep. Maybe it just shifts around where building happens. So up against that view, and Helm has an economics degree. Yeah. He's Dr. Helm. He studied economics. Up against that was a group, including Marco Garlick and Eleanor West, who had on a podcast here a couple of weeks ago. And Marco was giving a pretty down-the-line read of what I had understood to be the consensus of mainstream economists, that zoning to allow more housing will improve housing affordability and result in more building. The panel's ultimate decision, well, their report was almost insulting.
I know.
So they took Helm's characterization of what they viewed as being excess capacity in the district plan as being an inconvenient truth for people like Marco, who insist that easing restrictions would result in more housing. None of the panelists have any qualification in economics.
Architects and...
Yeah, people like there's that. A planner, a town planner, a resource consenting commissioner, a resource consenting consultant. Nobody knows anything about economics. Anyway, the New Zealand Economics Association put out a survey of its members. It does this every so often. And this time it was after the IHP review. The questions asked of the members of the Economics Association were, well, I'll just give the last one. They all gave the same result, and we'll put a link to it in the podcast at the end. But the final question asked of members was whether easing zoning constraints tends to result in increases in housing supply and improvements in housing affordability. And 98% of surveyed economists either strongly agreed or agreed with that proposition. The independent hearings panel, which didn't bother reading Marco's stuff, if I recall correctly from the discussions there, concluded differently on the basis of someone they took to be expert in it. I wonder what the hell is broken in our panel's process and in decisions of which experts ought to be listened to.
So I want to kind of put some sort of political and historical context around this, because it might sound a little bit abstract. It's Mount Victoria and, you know, economic discussion. And again, it all comes back to Robert Moses.
Yep.
So again, he's the city planner of New York, incredibly influential. Almost every city planner in the world sort of follows his lead and copies his method of doing things. And one of those methods of doing things is to build massive expressways just through communities, both through eminent domain. You seize the land, you kind of move people around. Moses is Jewish, but he really dislikes black people. So it's primarily kind of black and Hispanic communities that he just demolishes and builds highways yep. through. And yeah. And so that kind of becomes clocked as a major sort of an equity issue in the 1960s and 70s. And this book was it's a little bit obscure now, incredibly famous at the time. Yes. Won the Pulitzer Prize. Like, it just has a massive impact. And so
it's a massive book.
Yeah, yeah. And so it becomes obvious to politicians primarily on the left, I think, that you need voice when decisions are being made about what gets built where. You need to give, you know, like stakeholder engagement is the jargon that we use. You need local communities involved in these decisions. And it's hard to argue against that. But the sort of the downstream effect of that is that lots of development becomes incredibly conservative, because the people that dominate these local communities tend to be the people that own lots of property and are kind of resistant to any kind of change. You know, they don't want housing densification, for example, because it will devalue the value of their property just in kind of an obvious way. And so I think that's what we're seeing in the IHP. We're seeing people that own millions of dollars of houses and just don't really want to see that
now,
devalued. Yep.
There was a bit from Moses. I did not get all the way through the Power Broker. I got like maybe a sixth of the way through the Power Broker. And I'm not even sure if this part was in that early section. But didn't Moses make sure that when they were building highways, the bridges and the overpasses were low enough that buses from poor communities couldn't make it through into where the rich people lived?
So, yes, this is a really famous passage in that book. So he's both a hero and a villain, right? And so he is the first city planner that decides we should have access to beaches. People that live in cities should have, you know, beach resorts near to where they live. People should be able to go to the beach. And so he builds these just massive expressways and gigantic beaches for public access. But he really doesn't want black people at his beaches. And he very much considers themselves his beaches. And so white people are car owners, white middle class people, Jewish people. People that he wants there can drive a car, but if you live in a black neighborhood, you probably don't own one, so you'll be taking the bus. And so, yeah, the low overpass so that buses can't drive underneath them and make it to the beach is the archetypal Robert Moses building discrimination into just like the fundamental infrastructure of the city.
Yeah, I think that at least on the free market side of the right, the racist origins of zoning and a lot of town planning are very widely acknowledged. Yeah.
So Francis Fukuyama has this great phrase for what happens when you give local voice for everything.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it a vetocracy.
Yep.
Because anyone can kind of say, no, I'm local, I speak on behalf of my community, and I don't want any change. And so you end up with this process where nothing can really happen because you've given too much voice. So it's this kind of, we've seemed to have overcorrected massively and given voice to people like the IHP in Wellington, who, you know, just assume almost certainly acting in their own self-interest, probably persuading themselves that there aren't. And I think the significance of the Wellington IHP is that it's probably replicated just across everything, all across the country. You'll have some kind of, you know, local potentates that have decided, no, we benefit from the status quo, so we just kind of want to veto any change. And there's this great phrase in the public choice theorists, which I know you're a huge fan of, rational vandalism, which is when you decide that you're going to impose massive costs on your society because it benefits you in some way. So by preventing housing densification, like, that is just imposing a massive cost on the city. It's, you know, the university can't get students because there's nowhere for them to live, and it's preventing the expansion of the ratepayers to pay for all these pipes. And so it's a gigantic cost, but it benefits them in this quite relatively small way, orders of magnitude less, but because they can do it, they will.
Yeah. And then you start thinking about, well, given that as a constraint, like, okay, you dictator, me dictator, we both push the button and we allow an awful lot more building, but nobody's going to give either of us that button.
No.
So how do you best respond to that kind of current veto power? I'm a big fan of, there's an online magazine called Works in Progress. I don't know if you follow them at all.
No.
Well, they'd recently put up some work looking at a different way of handling this that's been happening in Houston. So there, they did kind of a very broad-scale upzoning like the MDRS, the medium density residential standard here that allows up to three houses of up to three stories on any residential lot.
Yep.
But rather than have wide-ranging special character areas that would let those with intense preferences against development block things on a wider area, they instead set it as a really hyper-local exclusion area where you needed to get your neighbors to agree. So if everybody on your street said, no, we're not going to have development on our street, I think it wasn't everybody, it was a majority or a supermajority, but you could get your street exempted from the MDRS rules on something like a 15 or 20 year renewal. So for a limited period, the rules will not apply on our street. It will get reviewed again in a couple of decades, and maybe we'll come to a different decision in a couple of decades. To me, that seems like an awful lot more sensible than broad scale character zones around areas of honestly pretty dubious character. It gives a way for those with the most intense anti-development preferences to exercise those around their own properties, so long as enough of their neighbors agree with them and everybody else gets left alone and is able to build.
So what do you think of the ability to designate some sites as heritage status, like in Wellington, famously, they just designated a water tank, which again seems like a kind of parody of heritage listings, doesn't it?
Yeah, the whole process is broken, and I've talked about this a few times in different various columns and I think in podcasts. But okay, starting point. There exists real heritage amenity, and some of that has flow-on benefits for people who do not own the building.
Yeah.
We can grant that. Some older buildings do have that character. Our current apparatus tries to protect and preserve that amenity for others by putting really costly regulatory impositions on the owners of the buildings that provide that amenity. That has led some owners to just neglect them so that eventually they'll get arsoned and solve the problem that way. Other ones are just continuing to rot, like the Gordon Wilson flats. Yep. We have decided to put the burden of providing a public benefit on the owner of the building who makes the decision about whether to maintain it and how. And there really doesn't seem to be that much recourse for the owners of the buildings. During the IHP process, owners of some houses that were being listed against the wishes of the owners of those houses because the houses needed a lot of repair and it is going to be almost impossible to effect a repair to a house once it's got a heritage listing on it. They hired consultants and put in tons of work to try and keep their houses from being so listed. Like, some people can afford to do that, others can't, and the ones that can't are then never going to be able to afford to fix their houses. You could flip the whole system around. So instead of trying to do it through regulatory imposition, where council will have incentive to over-designate, because they face no budget constraint, right? They're not saying you can't designate more than like 1% of the housing estate, or you can't designate more than 1,000 buildings, or whatever you want to put on as a constraint that forces trade-offs. They can just designate whatever the hell they want, right? There's no constraint, no trade-offs, no thinking. The other way of doing it, set a budget. Central government would contribute to it, maybe co-fund. So if within a council area, the council wants to put money towards preserving and maintaining heritage buildings, they could pay an annual subsidy to the owners of those buildings for the amenity that they provide. Central government could co-fund it, and then there could be crowdfunding for those who are really deep aficionados of heritage. They could put money into it too. That money would pay the owners for that benefit. Having a budget forces hard thinking about what's worth maintaining and what isn't and where to actually put the money.
I remember years ago when I was in Bath, I don't know if you've been there in the UK, an old kind of Roman spa town, and it has the most amazing like heritage listings to the point where there's a road called the Royal Crescent, which is a perfect crescent shaped stretch of townhouses. And there was a notice on the door of one of them, and we just went and had a look. And the heritage listing is so severe that the owners couldn't put new curtains up in the window on their floor without notifying the area that this was going to happen. And like, but you can veto that if you are kind of, yeah, so that's just the most extreme version of that kind of vetocracy where you have no constraints whatsoever, so you can just impose anything you like.
So it's a problem with heritage designations and character listings, but it goes broader than that, right? Like you talk to people who are involved in property development and they trying to get their plans approved by council. It will often go to a design board that will mandate that you have to have some offsets and that you have non-monolithic space. Like if you've got a row of townhouses, they have to be kind of offset. And yet it even went down to the color of the doors having to be specified. When you buy a house, you can repaint the door any darn color you want. But a developer was having his plan knocked back because the character assessment board didn't like the color of the doors. Now, I don't know who decided that a few bureaucrats should have that kind of power, but it seems insane when you're in a housing crisis.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, all I have is an agreement. We were also going to talk about that kind of failure of ideology that we seem to be hitting up against at this moment in our political history, this idea that, you know, there's this sort of eternal struggle of left and right, states versus markets, and we've just had a left-wing government for 6 years, and we have a left-wing local council in Wellington that is in a state of crisis. And, you know, the assumption on the left is always, well, the state just outperforms the market, and it's going to be more efficient because it's not competitive, and so we need to have a more just and compassionate society, you need to be government and state solutions. And that just seems to have hit a really hard wall in a way that is, I think, kind of isn't really part of the discussion on the left at the moment. That, you know, a left-wing council in Wellington is going to be implementing user pays, water meters, and possibly the new water organization is going to be raising debt on the financial markets. And so, and these are like, this is neoliberalism, right? It's right-wing market-based solutions. Because there's no real alternative that is being put up, other than some of the councils are saying, well, the cause of all this is austerity, and we just didn't have enough rates that we were charging, so we just need to massively increase the amount of rates, which is, again, I think, going to impact on unreality, and they'll all get voted out because people in Wellington do pay quite a lot of rates. So do you sort of have that feeling? Like, is that a sort of gut feeling at the New Zealand Initiative that this is sort of a moment?
Well, it feels like we go through cycles where if government is being relatively competent in delivering services and is showing that it's delivering value, then there starts to be a lot of demand for government to become more expansive. And this seems to be kind of a potted history of the last decade and a half, right? So English was running the investment approach. It seemed to be delivering results. We were seeing sharp declines in child poverty on any of the anchored measures. Things were seeming to work pretty well. People came to the view that government could then be trusted to do an awful lot more things. Labor was elected in 2017. Rather than continue with the approach that was working and then use that to add more bits to what government would be doing, along with the accountability frameworks and measurement to make sure that what they were doing was working, they threw out the checking on whether anything was working. Stepaloni did that pretty explicitly when she was head of Ministry for Social Development. It was just...
They did it in the health sector as well. All of the sort of better public service targets. Almost the first thing to go, which is interesting.
Yeah, and targets around vaccination, those get thrown out, and then you see vaccination rates decline, and then we get a measles outbreak. In some ways, we were lucky to have had the measles outbreak because it reminded the government that you can have communicable disease issues. So we had a series of spectacular blowouts. We had a very good response in March through May 2020, but a lot of incompetence otherwise. Voters then reasonably come to a view that the state has probably overextended and needs to retrench a little bit and get back to what it's better at.
So one of the things I've been thinking about is that there's a kind of assumption on the left, and a lot of people on the left wouldn't even know this term, that the public sector is a Weberian bureaucracy. From the German sociologist, it's hierarchical, so everybody just kind of follows directions as, you know, come down from ministerial offices or wherever. It's rational. It's rule following, it's efficient. And if you don't sort of interrogate that and look at the way things actually work, I think that is a core assumption. And I think it's a central assumption of Ardernism, that you just give the experts the money and tell them to be kind. And just all the good things are going to flow from that. That's really going to turn things around. It's all you really need. All of these kind of targets and measures like, why would you have that if you have a Weberian bureaucracy? It's just going to be getting in the way of the kind experts, right?
And you had a bit on this on the Democracy Project, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did Aranga Tamariki ever fail to get money that they had asked for?
I don't think so. And that's something that was in this piece I wrote in the Democracy Project. One of the somebody I know that was like a left-wing political operative, I'm going to call them, that Aranga Tamariki just got everything they wanted every year. Every review, I think that organization's been reviewed 30 times in the last 30 years. And so under Labour, it got everything. And it seems worse than ever. The ombudsman just was in the paper saying it just needs to be shut down and start again because it's so dysfunctional. So that's quite a hard question for the model of the Weberian bureaucracy. How can you give an organization, like a really important organization, if you're on the left and you're worried about, you know, children, how can you give it everything it wants and make it so much worse? And so the piece I wrote sort of says there's like a principal agent problem at work here, which is that often these organizations tend to sort of want to maximize their own budget as opposed to deliver more efficient services to the people that they're supposed to be working for. And so, and the larger the government gets, the larger the scale, the more you have this principal agent problem, because the more agents there are, and the principal is, you know, 123 MPs in this case. So they kind of have less and less ability to, you know, manage their agents. And also, if you get rid of any kind of targets or anything, that's, again, that's destroying your ability to sort of solve that problem.
And that's what Minister English had been seeming to try to solve in the investment approach, yeah. Right? So you had metrics on whether things were delivering or not, and you had contestability where NGOs could prove themselves to be better at delivering the outcomes that ministers and parliament wanted as compared to the ministries, and had real opportunities to expand their scope for others to then pick up the kinds of methods that they were using. It all seemed really promising. And had it worked out, you could see a reasonable case for increasing the size and scope of government, right? Yeah. That if the marginal dollar taken in tax is actually delivering an awful lot more value, it's harder to argue against tax increases.
Yeah, I mean, I think social investment is a fundamentally like left-wing idea that kind of got destroyed because it came out of a right-wing, you know, government and a conservative minister. The story I heard, I haven't heard this from English, but the story I heard from someone in National is that there was an initiative in education, personal development for teachers, and that it had been funded for like $80 billion or something, and it's how you kind of give money to sort of teachers to build their skills in the Department of Education.
There's no way they got $80 billion for that.
Oh, sorry, $80 million. Okay. Yeah. And the Ministry of Education came back to English and said, oh, this is such a successful project. We need all the money that you have. Put this into that because the outcomes are just that good. And English said, can you show me the data?
Yeah.
They said, the what now? And so it was just like they were hearing from teachers that they liked it. And that was the justification for just a massive expansion. And that was English's sort of thing, that maybe there's a better way to be doing this than just officials sort of drifting around saying, this seems good. Let's, you know, put another couple of dozen million dollars into it.
The budget process always has ministries fighting with each other for vote allocations and ministers representing their ministries, trying to get more money for their ministry. If you have a minister of finance who fundamentally wants to know that the money that is being allocated across those votes is effective, then that changes everything all the way down through the rest of the system because ministries figure out that they're not going to get more money unless they can put up evidence showing that it is delivering value relative to other things the government could be spending money on. When the Minister of Finance's decisions, a cabinet, on allocating across different votes is based on that kind of evidence, ministries start gearing themselves up to produce evidence that would be helpful in that process. When the Minister of Finance fundamentally doesn't care about that, all of that filters back down through. I remember early during the Labour administration, people, the reports back that you hear from people around town, the ministry stopped being scared of Treasury because Treasury's assessment of whether they were saying the stuff that they were saying was full of crap or not, it just didn't matter anymore.
No. And it became, I mean, well-being became, you know, the framework with, I think, 27 metrics or something. That's pretty easy to game. And all you had to say is, we just think it will improve the metric. And one of the phenomena that was quite fascinating about that era is that often you would get funds allocated. Mental health was the most notorious, and it just sat there. And, you know, that's what social bonds and social investment is supposed to solve, which is you know, it'll be saying to the private service, there's money here, it's yours if you can buy these bonds and you'll get the yield if you demonstrate the money is there, do you want it or not? And the private sector, people will say, yeah, we would like to make this money. But if there's no incentive for a public sector organization to do anything with that money, it just sits there for years. And in that case, during a mental health crisis, the money just, hundreds of millions just sat there.
Yeah. I think fundamentally the ministries realized that English's approach was a giant threat.
Yeah.
That if the minister has at his fingertips a dashboard showing the different outcomes that different NGOs can provide for which prices, if we go back to public choice, one of the big advantages that ministries have over their minister is controlling information.
Information asymmetry.
Right?
Yeah.
And ministries like to be able to bundle things together as a package where some service that the minister really cares about, well, that can only be delivered in conjunction with a whole pile of other stuff that the minister might not care about, but the ministry cares about. You put a joint budget together for both of those and force the minister to approve a bunch of bullshit. If you've got a dashboard instead that the things that the minister cares about, you can go back to the ministry and say, well, actually, I don't know what all this other stuff is, but the thing that I care about in here, I've got five NGOs that can deliver it for a third of the price of what you're wanting for it. Yeah. So, sorry, your line budget is going to be cut tremendously, and we're going to fund agencies that work. One of the best talks that I'd heard at the Waikato Economics Forum last week was the head of Whanaora. She was talking about just the black hole of social service funding and how nobody knows what outcomes are being delivered out of that black hole. And meanwhile, you've got NGOs that are deeply embedded in their communities, figure out what works, are able to deliver outcomes. And we need to stop pouring money into the black hole and actually deliver it to the spots that are working. She was also an RNZ on the Oranga Tamariki one, arguing that the agency should just be disbanded, given how colossal a failure it's been.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if they can get social investment kind of back up and running and working again. I wrote something, a piece for the listener about social investment a couple of years ago, and I kind of had almost a Damascene moment because I was talking to Impact Lab, which is you know, Bill English's charity that does the social impact measurement, and I was talking to the various charities that they were funding, and they were doing, you know, there's like a doctor in Rotorua who is kind of basically doing house visits because they've figured out that that's a massively impactful thing for them to be doing for families that are just living in abject poverty. They can't get to even an emergency ward or a doctor's surgery until their condition is absolutely critical, and it could have been solved just with really easy. So anyway, that was one of the charities, and there was another one working, setting up like men's refuges. So if someone throws their violent partner out of the house, they have a place to go, which is, again, a massively impactful thing that you can do to minimize violence, because if they have nowhere to go, they go back home again. And so anyway, these were people that were really, it's coalface stuff. It's very, very real. And at the same time, a friend of mine was attending a massive conference in Wellington for public sector comms departments, and it was how to decolonize your website. And everything was internally focused on the bureaucracy itself. And being a social justice activist within your kind of public sector role, and maybe that stuff has marginal utility, I kind of suspect it doesn't, but the idea that there are people out there living in abject poverty or victims of violent domestic abuse is just not even like on the radar at all, and that maybe that should, you know, be a problem that the public sector should be helping with. So yeah, that was my Damascene moment, that this seems like an approach that is worth taking.
Well, hopefully the government gets back to the investment approach. There seems to be a lot of demand for it. It is one of the things that did have agreement at the Waikato Forum. The big areas of agreement were on the need for fiscal consolidation, basically getting budgets back in line. We have a massive structural deficit, largely because government spending increased by about four times as much as government revenues increased. Getting those back in line will matter. That will mean some spending cuts, but it can also give an opportunity to refocus spending in areas where it can really make a difference. This has been very wide-ranging. I don't know if we've solved all the world's problems.
Maybe 40%.
40%. We've gone through a bit of Wellington. We haven't touched the other cities, but perhaps we'll deal with those in another conversation.
Great. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a lot of fun.
Cheers.